Verse 1, now a certain man was sick, Lazarus. Verse 3, his sisters send to Jesus, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. Lazarus is not just a faceless person to Jesus. It's someone that he especially loves, as were Mary and Martha. Verse 5, now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. But knowing that, verse 6 is a bit disconcerting. When therefore he heard that he was sick, he stayed there 2 days longer in the place where he was. Well, that's a strange response to a crisis enveloping someone that Jesus loved. Why didn't Jesus go to help? Jesus was the healer. Lazarus is sick. Jesus is the miracle worker. Why is Jesus delaying? Even if he was going to have a moratorium on miracles, wouldn't he at least go to sympathize Lazarus, whom he loved? And then, verse 11, we hear Jesus saying to his disciples, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep. He reaffirms how close Lazarus is to all of them. At this point, they don't realize that Lazarus has died. They just think he's literally sleeping. And so Jesus explains to them, verse 14, that Jesus said to them plainly, Lazarus is dead. And then he says, strikingly, I am glad. Yep, it's not a misprint. I am glad for your sakes that I was not there. Well, up till now, you just thought, I know what you're thinking. It's like he's reading way too much into Jesus' delays. He's intimating that it was intentional, probably, you know, the car broke down or something. But here, doubt is removed. Jesus gets explicit about his choices and his motives. He says, I was glad for your sakes that we hung around here and didn't head over there. I'm glad for your sakes that I was not there. Glad. Glad for Lazarus to die. Glad to see Mary and Martha's pain and tears. Martha didn't understand. Verse 21. Martha therefore said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Mary says virtually the same thing. Verse 32. When Mary meets him, she falls at his feet and says, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Where were you? In our hour of need, when you could have made a difference. Mary weeps, verse 33. Lazarus's Jewish friends weep. Even Jesus weeps, verse 35. And some of the Jews ask, verse 37. Some of them said, could not this man, who opened the eyes of him who was blind, have kept this man also from dying? So here's the question. Why? Why did Jesus delay? If Jesus cares, why did he let his loved ones suffer and sorrow? And things went from bad, he was sick, to worse, he died. Jesus did not intervene, though he obviously could have. Mary and Martha attest to that. Lord, if you had been here. It's not just a question for first century Bible times. It's a relevant question for you and me. What's going on in your life? Where have you been disappointed? Where have you been hurt? Where have you been sinned against? Where are you suffering? Perhaps you are suffering and powerless and you're questioning, why would God let this happen? Where is God? Maybe you're ill. Maybe you're aging. I suppose we all are. and you're losing health and vitality. Or maybe this is happening to someone that you love dearly, like Mary and Martha. Why? Why is God letting this happen? Jesus let things go from bad to worse. First, Lazarus is sick, yet Jesus delays to come and Lazarus dies. Maybe that's been your experience as well. Bad to worse. And this question haunts you. Why does Jesus let the ones he loves suffer? Well, there are two answers that are very clear in this passage. There are other answers, but we'll focus on what is clear from the records of Jesus in the Lazarus situation. First, Jesus lets the ones he loves suffer to glorify God and the Son of God. Jesus explains this to us early in this passage. Verse 1, a certain man was sick. It's not just any man. Verse 3, the sisters say, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. So they've drawn two conclusions. Mary and Martha have drawn two conclusions. First, something about the identity of the person afflicted. Behold, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. Lazarus is the person you love. You are not indifferent to what happens to him. Second conclusion, the identity of his greatest problem. First, the identity of the person afflicted, then the identity of his greatest problem. He's sick. That's his greatest problem. And if you do not intervene, this sickness will end in death. And this situation demands your help. You love him. We love him. Many love him. The greatest evil is if he dies. The greatest good is if you heal him and he recovers. Read on. Verse 4, when Jesus heard this, what they had said, behold, he whom you love is sick. Well, Jesus has something to say about their two conclusions. When Jesus heard it, he said, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified by it. So Jesus affirms their first assessment. In verse 5, now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So, yes, indeed, Jesus did love Lazarus. And Jesus loved those who loved him, Mary and Martha. Those who would be most affected by his sickness and death. So they're right on number one. Number two, however, their second assessment is incorrect. According to Jesus, verse 4, he is sick. But this sickness is not unto death. The outcome of this sickness will not be death. Well, yes, he will die. Yes, he will die, but I will resurrect him. And he won't end up dead. I will not leave him in death, but I will bring him back to life. And his sickness will end in life. This sickness is not unto death, but he must go through death to get there. So the outcome of this sickness, read it again, this sickness is not unto death. The outcome is not so much death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified by it. The outcome of this sickness is going to be the glory of God. It's not about death so much as glory be to God on high. And more specifically, the Son of God. People will be amazed at what God can do rescuing a man from the final enemy. And the Son of God, God the Son, will be glorified because he will be the visible and active agent of resurrection power. He calls forth Lazarus from the grave with an irresistible call. We see this again in verse 40. Jesus said to her, to Martha, did I not say to you, if you believe, you will see the glory of God? The glory of God will be visible to believing eyes. Now, if you're unbelieving, you'll see nothing of the glory of God. You'll explain it all away. You'll dismiss it as much ado about nothing. That's still going on today. But for those who believe, you'll see a dead man return to life. You'll see Lazarus walking out of the tomb with his burial garments on. The smell of decay and death will be blown away by the winds of Jesus' power. Impossibility, death, becomes reality, life. Now, I mean, we're talking 2014, and modern medicine and drugs and therapies cannot perform this. Dead men are dead. God's power, God's love, God's care, and God's glory are seen as Lazarus walks out of a tomb in good health and under his own power, out of the tomb, into life. The glory of God. Whoa, where did that come from? Never seen that before. It's the glory of God. And the Son of God, who said, Lazarus, come forth, is glorified. Yeah, now, understand, if Lazarus had not been sick, and in fact, if Lazarus had not gone from sickness to death, God's power and God's glory would not have been openly seen. God let Mary and Martha and the friends of Lazarus experience great sorrow, because that was the only way that Jesus' miracle of resurrection could be so radical, and the glory of God would be obvious. Jesus let the ones he loved suffer to glorify God and the Son of God. The second reason from this text is that Jesus lets the ones he loved suffer to increase their faith. That was great. Bernard just nailed it in the scripture reading. 1:2. But it's right there in the text. In fact, this is there again and again, and we'll see this with a couple of different groups. First, Jesus let his loved ones suffer so that his disciples may believe. Verses 7 through 16. Now, Jesus will lead his disciples beyond where they currently were. They were severely disabled in the level of their thoughts and understandings. They had limited spiritual resources and capacity. The works that they could do for him were all downgraded, and their faith was weak. Specifically, we see in this passage, first of all, with respect to their understanding of the mission of Jesus, verses 7 through 10. The disciples had a deficient understanding of Jesus' mission. This was important. Verse 7, Jesus says, "Let's go to Judea." Why did Jesus say that? Well, because he must go to the cross. And to go to the cross means he must return to the epicenter of opposition, Judea and Jerusalem. The disciples say, verse 8, and our speech always reveals where we are at, way more than we think. They say, hey, this is risky. You know what's going to happen if we go back there? They're after you. They're going to get you. It's going to be all over. Don't expose yourself to the risk. We should not go to Judea. Not understanding that the cross is at the end of the journey to Judea. Not understanding for Jesus and for us, the consuming necessity of the cross. Not realizing that the fact of falling into the hands of the Pharisees is not a risk, but a certainty. They are confused and unclear as to Jesus' fundamental mission. He came to die. He came for the cross. He came to give himself for his people. It's not to be avoided. It's not to be escaped. This is the point of it all. They didn't understand his mission. They had great need of growth, but they didn't have a clue as to the deficiency or how important it was for them to understand why Jesus had come. But Jesus will lead them to grow in faith, but he will lead them not to the destination or by the path that they might have chosen. Verses 9 and 10, Jesus says, if we're doing what God would have us do, if we walk in the day, we don't need to fear. You only need to fear if you walk in disobedience, walking in the night. God will guide his own. They did not understand the mission. But verses 11 through 15, they didn't understand the miracle thing. Verse 11, after that, he said, so here's a separate thing that he said, separate from the mission issue, is the miracle issue. The disciples didn't have a clear understanding of Jesus, of Lazarus' condition and the necessity of a miracle to restore him. Verse 11, Jesus says, Lazarus has fallen asleep. I'm going to go wake him up. They say, okay. What's the problem? He says, just let him go. He'll wake up on his own. Verse 13, Jesus says, I'm talking about death. Lazarus is dead. Sleep is metaphorical for death. The disciples are thinking he's snoring. In verse 14, Jesus unlocks the door of hidden meaning. He says plainly, Lazarus is dead. Get it now? And then he gives us real insight as to what he does and why he does it. Verse 14, Lazarus is dead, and I am glad for your sakes that I was not there, so that you may believe, but let us go to him. I am glad. I am glad for your sakes. Interesting. I am glad for your sakes. So this is for you. This is not just so that God will be glorified and you will be manipulated like pawns in a chess game, like God's going to bring himself out as the winner and you're just going to get used. I'm glad for your sakes. This is good for you. Why? I'm glad for your sakes that I was not there so that you may believe. So that you may believe. You have a need of faith. A greater and stronger faith, and I am working in these circumstances to grow that in you. So let's go. Time to ride. So they didn't. So with respect to Jesus' mission, they had a deficiency. With respect to the understanding of miracle, they had a deficiency. And then verse 16, Thomas blurts out that this issue of misery. Mission, miracle, misery. Thomas sees the dark side in every circumstance. Rough way to live. I know that. Maybe some of you do too. And yet, he's an incredibly loyal. Let us also go that we may die with him. This will end in death. Well, actually it will. He didn't know that. But he's going to go anyway. He's going to stick with Jesus. Life of Puddleglum. If you're not familiar with all the Chronicles of Narnia, you really should read them all. Then you'd understand what we... But so Jesus says, I am glad for your sakes that I was not there. Why? So that you may believe. What does this really mean? Believe. Believe what? Believe how? And how does that change things if you believe? Well, let's go over these three things. What didn't they understand? They didn't understand the mission of Jesus. The disciples must understand the mission of Jesus. They have to understand who he is. They have to understand why he has come. It's all about the cross. So that you may believe. They need to understand that Jesus has come to display himself, as he says clearly in verse 25, as the resurrection and the life. And Jesus himself, though he will die, will not remain dead because he is the resurrection and the life. Death will not be able to hold him. Death will then, turning point in history, death will then no longer be final. Death has been the ultimate power up until now, up until Jesus comes as the resurrection and the life, death has reigned supreme. death introduced by a man into this world. We looked at this last time. We were together, Romans 5:12, by Adam. And so death spread to all men, like a person with a highly contagious disease walking into a cancer unit at the U of M hospital, where every person's on chemo and has suppressed immunity. They're all in trouble. Death spread like wildfire, and it touched every man. Romans 5:14, death reigned. And until Jesus has come as the resurrection and the life, death is reigning. But this is the mission of Jesus. He is the resurrection and the life. 1 Corinthians 15:26, the last enemy that will be abolished is death. But that process of destruction starts now. As Jesus calls forth Lazarus, and shortly he will be in the tomb, and he will come forth. Death will no longer be final, because Jesus is the resurrection and the life, and Jesus himself will be the first fruits of those who are asleep. 1 Corinthians 15:20. What's that mean? This is what it means. When the first apple of summer appears on the tree, you know there's more to come. There's going to be apple trees filled with apples, and that first apple lets you know the whole harvest is coming. Or a more appropriate illustration, when the first dandelion of spring appears, you know that your whole lawn will soon be yellow, not green. Now, if you're good and spray and all that, it's your neighbor's yard that will be yellow. That first dandelion is not appear by itself. They're coming, baby. They're coming for your lawn. Jesus was the first fruits of those who slept. Jesus is the first one to be resurrected. And when Jesus rises, it means all of those who belong to Jesus will rise too. As sure as the yellowness appears all throughout your lawn after the first dandelion appeared, so when Jesus is raised, all those who are Jesus will be raised as well. Jesus is the resurrection and the life. You can't hold it down. You can't stop it. It's a coming. Jesus' resurrection is the guarantee of the resurrection of his people. Jesus is here declaring himself as the resurrection and the life. He demonstrates it as he brings Lazarus to life. And the disciples must understand the mission of Jesus as the resurrection and the life, so that you may believe. And the disciples must behold the miracles of Jesus. They will see his power. They will believe that this power comes from God. They will see what he can do more than ever before. Look, he's made blind men see, and he's healed lepers, and he's made the lame walk, but never before has a dead man come to life. Never before has death been the loser and life been the winner. Not until Jesus raises Lazarus. And this is convincing proof that he is who he says he is, the Son of God. And the eyewitnesses, Peter and John, still speak of what they saw. We were there. We saw it. It happened. Validating his power and his claims for all those who will see the believing and listen. Yes, you can know. The disciples must understand the mission of Jesus. The disciples must behold the miracles of Jesus. And then hope replaces misery, because death is overcome by life. Death is emptied of its sphere like a milk carton with a hole in it. All the milk leaks out, and you just have an empty milk carton. It's light. There's no milk there. It says milk on it, but there's no milk there. It's an empty shell. And death has had all the milk, all the fear, all the threat leak out of it. It's just an empty shell. The label still reads death. But it's an empty milk carton. Hope replace a sphere. I'm glad for your sakes that I was not there, so that you may believe. Understand the mission of Jesus. Behold the miracles of Jesus, and have hope replace misery. Well, Jesus let his loved ones suffer so that the disciples may believe. In the second place, Jesus let his loved ones suffer so that Martha may believe, verses 17 through 40. Now, the interesting thing here is that Martha already believed. That's very clear, and we'll see that as we walk through this passage. Martha already believed. But Martha will take her, or Jesus will take Martha where she has not yet been. He will increase her faith. Notice that Martha believed in Jesus, verse 21. Martha therefore said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Martha believed in Jesus. If you had been here, this wouldn't have happened. Jesus would have made the difference. And this is a believing statement, not a blaming statement. She's not blaming Jesus because of what follows in verse 22. Martha believed in Jesus. Then Martha believed in prayer. Verse 22. "Even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you." Even now, even though Lazarus is dead, now that's a mind stretcher because nobody from the dead has ever been raised again. Even now I know, I'm convinced. She still believes. Now, I don't think she's entirely clear as to what Jesus will do, but she is pretty firm as to what Jesus can do. Martha believed that Jesus could pray, and he would pray in verses 41 and 42. Martha believed that Jesus' prayer, or shall we say, Martha believed that prayer had validity and viability. "I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you." Things happen when you pray, Jesus. You know, if you believe in Jesus, and if you believe in prayer, you've got yourself a winning combination. Even in the worst of circumstances, do you believe in Jesus? Do you believe in prayer? Or is it religious rhetoric? Could you say what Martha said? "Even now I know that whatever you ask of God, even now I know that whatever I ask of God, now I know that whatever we ask of God, God will give it." Well, Martha believed in Jesus. Martha believed in prayer. And Martha also believed in the resurrection. Verse 23, Jesus said to her, "Your brother shall rise again." She responds, verse 24, "Well, I know." Again, she knows. And Martha, this is faith. Martha says, "I know that he'll rise again at the last day." She interpreted Jesus' statement, "Your brother shall rise again," as referring to the resurrection on the last day. It's the distant future, yet she did believe, number one, in the certainty, "I know," of resurrection. And she believed in the specificity of resurrection, not just that a bunch of people will be raised, but yes, my brother, he will rise. I know that he will rise. It's going to be a long time off. But Martha believed in the resurrection. She was no slouch as to what she believed. But Jesus will lead her further to grow her understanding and faith. And it starts right now, verse 25. Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me shall live even if he dies. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die." Do you believe this? "I am the resurrection and the life. here and now, in your presence, today. Not just for the resurrection someday out there, but I am the resurrection and the life. In other words, the resurrection and the life are not just theological concepts to be relegated to the distant future. It's not like a pair of cufflinks that you put in the drawer to pull out only for formal occasions. Have we got cufflinks on? No, they're in the drawer. Resurrection life, that's blue jeans. It's for everyday life. Everyday life, it's tennis shoes. I am the resurrection and the life. When you believe in Jesus, death is redefined. Its significance is severely limited. Its power is hobbled. Its reach is put on a leash. I am the resurrection and the life. Martha, do you believe this? Do you know who Jesus is? This is a life-transforming concept. This is not just about doctrine in a dusty old book, but this is for daily life. Do you believe in Jesus? Do you believe in this Jesus? And, you know, you can quasi-know it's like true and he's all that, but it's not for you. That's not what Jesus is talking about to Martha. He says, do you believe this? Do you believe in me? Now this is a matter of life and death. It's a matter of your life and death. Do you believe in Jesus? And if you do, if you do, he who believes in me shall live even if he dies. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? In other words, you may die. Well, you're going to die. It's appointed a man once to die. To die is human. It's inescapable. The point is, that is not the last chapter of the story. You don't get to death and then it says the end. Now turn the page. There's another chapter. The story goes on. He who believes in me shall live even if he dies. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die, in another sense. We're not done. At death, really, we're just beginning. Do you believe this, Martha? You have to believe it. You have to personally believe it. Now, he has said that he who believes in me shall live. And he said that everyone who lives and believes in me. The question is, do you believe this? It's not about them. It's not about a mushy definition of humanity. Everyone. It's about you. Do you believe this? Will you commit yourself to Jesus? Not that you will or can be perfect. Not that you're going to solve the world's problems. You as a sinner, in all your failings, commit yourself to Jesus. Do you believe in Jesus? Well, Martha's response, verse 27, with no hesitation or reluctance, she says, yes, Lord. Yes, Lord, I have believed that you are the Christ, the Son of God, even he who comes into the world. Yes, Lord, my faith is real and valid. I have believed. I still believe. Martha was for real. And this was the ultimate and true confession. And she says, you are God. You are the Christ. You are the Son of God. You came into this world. Which means that this person that she's speaking with, if you came into this world, it means you existed before this world was. You have an existence separate from the man Jesus who I'm speaking to. You came into this world. That's quite a statement now. She's saying you were the Son of God before you were Jesus. She believed. She believed. No ambiguity there. By the way, this confession would get you in trouble with the religious leaders. John 9:22, it said that the Pharisees had agreed that if anyone should confess him to be Christ, he should be put out of the synagogue. that she believes. Well, then Mary comes, verses 32 and 33, asks the same question as Martha. And she says, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Mary's weeping, verse 33, "when Jesus therefore saw her weeping," which reminds us of another Mary, John 20:11, who is weeping at the tomb of Jesus because someone that she loved had died. The thing is that both Marys will have their tears ended by the same Jesus who is the resurrection and the life. Jesus responds to her sadness. He is moved by her sorrow, verse 33, deeply moved in spirit and troubled, verse 35, Jesus wept, verse 38, he is again deeply moved within. Yeah. Sometimes we ask, where's Jesus? Does he care? Does he see? Well, you know, if Jesus on earth could care and weep, even though he's about to resurrect Lazarus, how much more the glorified Jesus in heaven cares and sees our sorrows, fears, and tears. Jesus prepares to bring Lazarus forth, verse 39. "Remove the stone. Remove the stone. Get the stone out of the way because I'm going to call him forth out of the tomb." Well, here Martha's faith stumbled. Her faith was not so strong as it appeared, not so strong as she wanted it to be, like the disciples who fled at Jesus' arrest. We all proved to be weaker than we thought. "Remove the stone," Martha says. Well, wait a minute. Let's think about the risks here. Let's think about the consequences. It's going to be real. It's going to smell really bad. I mean, if we fail, this is going to be, this will be in the papers tomorrow. "Before I obey Jesus, I'm not so sure about this. I'm not sure if I want to do this. I mean, what if the dots don't connect? What if I end up looking stupid? What if I fail again?" Jesus wants you to believe. Jesus responds, verse 40. Check it out. Jesus said to her, "Did I not say to you, if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" She's saying, "I don't know if we should move that stone." Jesus says, "Look, I told you, if you believe, you will see the glory of God." Martha, you're faltering. Firm up your faith. Martha, believe. Believe me. Believe in me. Now, I know it looks like this plane's going to crash, but I'm the pilot. I'm in the cockpit. I'm at the controls. Believe in me. Well, Jesus lets his loved ones suffer so that the disciples may believe, so that Martha may believe. And then finally, Jesus let his loved ones suffer so that many will believe, verses 41 through 45. Many Jews had come, verse 19, to console Mary and Martha. Verses 41 and 42, Jesus prays, "These many are still around." And when Jesus prays, he's conscious of these people standing around. "Father, I thank thee that thou heardest me, and I knew that thou hearest me always, but because of the people standing around, I said it, that they may believe that thou didst send me." So just before he calls forth Lazarus from the tomb, he prays. And he prays conscious that these people are listening so that they will know that the prayer goes to God. The power comes from God. This is the act of God. Glory will return to God. And the Son of God is sent by God, used by God, blessed by God, and then glorified by God. That they may believe. That they may believe what? That thou didst send me. That Jesus came from God on a mission for God. And so if this is true, then everything that Jesus has said is true. and everything that Jesus has claimed is true. It goes back and validates all of his works and all of his words that thou didst send me. It's not so simple, like that simple, and not that Jesus had power over sickness and death, profound insight into man and God, but he is sent from God. Well, Jesus prays, verses 41 and 42. Jesus commands, the dead one comes to life. Think about that, though. It's not that Lazarus obeyed when Jesus said, Lazarus, come forth, because Lazarus is dead. Dead people don't obey. What obeyed was death itself. The power of death had to be loosened before Lazarus could respond. When Jesus performs the miracle, it demonstrates that Jesus, the resurrection and the life, has power over death. It's not just that Jesus commands Lazarus to come forth, but it's that Jesus commands death to bow and to give it up. And so Jesus, the resurrection and the life. Lazarus comes forth. In verse 45, many, therefore, of the Jews who had come to Mary and beheld what he had done, believed in him. That was the point. In fact, you can go on to the next chapter, chapter 12, verses 9 through 11. They're still talking about Lazarus. They're still gathering around to see this man who returned from the dead. And many are continuing to come to Jesus. It continues to happen. Many are still believing. Well, there you have it. Why does Jesus let his loved ones suffer? To glorify God and to bring you to believe in Jesus. It's not enough to believe that you are strong. It is not enough to believe that your experience will solve your problems. It's not enough to believe that you have sufficient resources in the bank to prepare you for the future. It's not enough that you've always been healthy. It's not enough that the doctors can cure. You need to get your eyes on Jesus. You need to believe in Jesus, not yourself, not your resources, not your past, not your experience, not your past successes. Jesus wants to kick that in the head to get you to believe in Jesus. That's why he lets his loved ones suffer. That's why things come out of your hands that you've been holding on to all your life. That's why you feel yourself falling. To believe in Jesus, so that you may believe. I am the resurrection and the life. All your troubles, all your fears, all your worries, all the threats, all your anxieties, Jesus is the solution to all of them, from the least to the greatest. You know what the greatest is? Death. It's the big one. And death is the greatest. Understand. Not because death is the end. Oh, no. Death is not the end. Death is the door that locks behind you. There's no going back, no second chances, no rewriting your personal history. It's the door that locks behind you, and you face the judge. That's why death is so significant. Not because death is the end. Because death is the door that locks behind you. You say, I don't believe that. Well, you know, I guess I don't have anything to say to you then. Except this. What if you're wrong? What if you wake up one day and you die, and the door locks behind you, and there he is, judge of all the earth, looking you full in the eyes? Then what? What are you going to say then? What if it's all true? What if these sorry Christians were right? Think about it. Think about it in the dark. Think about it in your weakness. Think about it in your fears. Jesus wants you to believe. That's what this is all about. Jesus wants you to believe in Him. Jesus is the resurrection and the life. Jesus is the Son of God. Jesus has accomplished victory over sin and death. By the resurrection and the life, he who believes in me shall live even if he dies. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?